Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 81, recorded December 5th, 2012. Harper Reed. Triangulation is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter Triangulation. And by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker looking for video, photos, illustrations, music, sound effects, After Effects templates, or 3D models, check out Pond5. And for an exclusive 50 free stock media files, go to pond5.com/triangulation.
It's time for Triangulation. I just love doing this because I get to sit down with one of the big thinkers on the internet and spend an hour talking to them. And the triangulation, originally it was me and Tom Merritt, but now the triangulation is me and you. So if you're in our chat room watching live, get your questions ready for our guest this week, Harper Reed, who is, he'll be quick to tell you, not a werewolf. Harper is still the CTO of Obama for America. Good to see you, Harper. Thank you for joining us on Triangulation.
Well, hello. it's great to be here.
You don't remember, but you, me, Gina Trapani, and Ben Ha played a cutthroat game of werewolf at Foo Camp.
I remember. I was just saying that it's weird to have that nice booming radio voice actually be the werewolf.
I fooled everybody because I seemed so decent and sane.
Trustworthy.
High integrity. I'm a townsperson. Why would you ever think otherwise? So I want to go back a little farther than the election to you were the CTO at Threadless also, the great T-shirt company. Yeah,
that's correct.
So how did you get into all of this stuff? You were a computer science major?
I was a computer science major, but I think more than that, what brought me into technology, especially web technology, was just hacking on my own projects and spending a lot of time, probably too much time, doing that.
Yeah. In high school, is that how you got going? Or?
Yes, but I think where it really came was I got a job in Chicago after college, and I spent most of my time just trying to do interesting things. And around 2001, I built a web app called Audrey Hacking, which was about the 3Com Audrey, which you may
remember. Audrey! Oh, my God! That was 3Com's kitchen computer.
Yeah, so they...
It was horrible!
It failed. It was terrible. But a bunch of like hacker types bought them off eBay, and we were able to, through the help of some obviously great community, crack it open and install good software. And basically, for $100, you got a great little screen that could do whatever you wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I ran that community for a while, and what that did more than anything was introduce me to what could happen on the internet. Whereas before that, it was very read-only, and it became read-write, where I wasn't really a blogger. I wasn't, you know, obviously Twitter and Facebook and all this nonsense wasn't there yet. So I was suddenly just dropped in there, and I was like, oh, okay, we can build and facilitate communities, which played a huge part in the Threadless story.
Because Threadless was kind of community-driven, right? It was a crowdsourced.
Yeah, it was aggressively... Yes, aggressively. I mean, they still, to this day, all of their products are created by the community,
right?
Designed and whatnot. And so they started that around the same time that I was playing with my Audrey. And they built that up to a certain level. And then I came in around 2005 and helped them scale it to where they needed to be.
How did you learn all that kind of stuff? I mean, were we talking databases and all of that, or?
Yeah, and a lot of that came from me honestly just screwing around. And I accidentally, and this happens, I don't know why, every once in a while I'll stumble across something that just happens to be a little bit too complex for where I am currently in the skill-wise. And so I have to learn a bunch. This happened much more in the early 2000s and the late 90s than it did now, but mostly because I try not to do as much of that work anymore, even though I love it.
Yeah.
But it's still, it was still very much about testing and experimenting. And so I had a very terrible hosting company in the early 2000s that really I cut my teeth on. Also cut up all my credit cards because I bought a lot of servers. But it was, that's really what taught me. And so I had learned how to scale small sites for very little money. And so going into Threadless, where we suddenly had a budget, we were able to make it very big, very inexpensively, and that's, you know, the name of the game when you're scaling.
We should mention that Harper's in Chicago, lives near the L. Every once in a while, the train to the airport's going to go by.
It's true.
That's what you're hearing in the background. You majored in computer science and philosophy, which is a perfect combination, I think. Is that an official dual major at Cornell, or is that something you...
Well, you know, the college I went to was a small liberal arts college in Iowa.
Cornell, Iowa.
Right. I don't know the actual story, but I'm just going to make something up that I've always lived with in my head. This is how I thought it would go. They were like, hey, we need money, so we're going to pick some rich person's name. And they picked the Cornell family, and then the Cornell family was, hey, that's a really good idea. We're going to do our own college, and then didn't actually get Cornell. But I think they were founded like 20 years before the other Cornell. I have no idea. I imagine Wikipedia would help us here, but...
That's why I have a love-hate relationship with Twitter, because Twit was founded 2 years before Twitter.
Yeah. See, they're stealing your whole thing.
I asked Ev. I said, didn't you think that there was some conflict? Because he knew about Twit. He'd been on Twit. And he said, no, I didn't think either Twitter or Twit were going anywhere. So I wasn't too worried about it.
Yeah, I'm sure that's...
He was half right. So cool. So Threadless... and was Threadless a LAMP stack? Was it all open source stuff? Was it Linux, Apache, MySQL, that kind of thing?
So it was MySQL, Linux, PHP, a lot of PHP. And I left in 2009, so a lot has changed on the internet, and especially with server, you know, and hosting technologies. And so I'm not sure what it is now. But then, you know, we had a bunch of boxes, and we were just running as fast as we could with the goal of being very fast, because in e-commerce... You know, in any real web application, the faster you are, the better your conversion is.
Now, so how did you go from that to politics?
accidentally. This was not on purpose. I left in 2009, and we were just kind of messing about, trying to figure out what was next. So I was working with my partner in crime, Dylan Richard, at Dylan R, and we were just kind of hustling and doing weird stuff on the internet. When I'm trying to think what we did, all just nonsense, really. Nothing really, just hacking, honestly. So helping startups in Chicago, hacking on some stuff of our own, and hustling. And we started doing this thing at a coffee shop here in Chicago called this coffee shop Wormhole, which is pretty much Reddit packed into a coffee shop.
Cool.
So it's you know, they have a DeLorean and they have all this weird internet stuff. And so we were doing this thing every Friday there, and we were just hanging out quite a bit, trying to help facilitate the kind of the startup scene in Chicago, which has only started getting really important and working. And from there, I started meeting some more people and eventually met Michael Slaby, who was going to be my boss. I didn't know this at the time, who was just like, hey, I'd love to talk to you about some opportunities we have. And he basically said, I need a CTO and I need a bunch of engineers. And I said, I have all of those things. And I, at this point, wasn't really thinking that was myself. I was more thinking, oh, I could probably introduce him to a very good CTO type. And went through a bunch of conversations, which turned out to be interviews. I didn't really think about it. All my friends one day were like, hey, I think you're interviewing for the CTO role. And I was like, oh, That's a little bit different than I had in my head, because I was introducing Michael Slaby to all my friends, being like, hey, this guy, you know, he ran this big company. He might be a good example. Oh, this guy over here, he might, you know, he's looking for something to do. And there was this eventually we got to this point where all of us that were kind of like I would call my team were, let's do this campaign thing. And Slaby was like, why don't we meet up? So we met up and he talked through all of the parameters of what the campaign meant. And then we were like, okay, we're in. And that was like 6 or 7 people. And we all ended up working on the campaign, which is pretty amazing. And then much from then on.
It sounds so informal for something so serious.
I think what it was more so than it is informal is it's what I would call like the reality of hiring, which is it's networking.
Right.
So more than anything, it's just I was out there trying to meet people and I met this person who happened to be hiring for this important position. He threw a lot of kind of vetting. I'm sure he called around and talked to some people I worked with before, decided that I was the right person, as many of us have who've hired. That's just kind of how it works. And I think it's important, and it's like one of those silly things where you tell young people networking is very important. But I would not be where I am today if that wouldn't have been what I had been focusing on.
Isn't that interesting? It is something you got to keep in mind. Just the right place, the right time, who you know.
Yeah.
Now, in 2008, President Obama's campaign had people like Julius Genachowski, Clay Johnson. Clay wasn't part of that. He was part of the DNC. But what happened to them? Did they decide to start fresh in 2012?
This is actually something that's a little nuanced. The DNC has a whole technology stack of their own, but they support the whole country, all the down ballot races, all the just races all over. And they also support people between the presidential elections. And so every cycle, leadership changes inside the DNC, political excitement happens, and people come and they go. And so in 2008, I don't know really what happened. I keep telling people that I think in some victory pyre, they burnt all the code, but there wasn't a lot of code that was left over. Since it was so fast, it was basically from primary to primary to primary to primary, and then suddenly a general, they weren't able to there wasn't like a platform like we had in 2012. And we had a lot of time to build that. We had about 18 months. And so they just didn't have the same relationship with technology. They had engineers. They had a very small, like 4 or some small amount of number of engineers. And so after that election was won, certain people went to the DNC and they started working. Other people kind of went their separate ways. BSD, obviously, Blue State Digital, which was, Clay was on the one on the founding team,
right,
there, obviously, you know, grew and helped all sorts of organizations. And then when it came time to bring those people back, some of them came back. We had a couple of guys that were from 2008. Obviously, Michael Slaby, who I talked about, he was the CTO from 2008. Michael Conlow, who was my deputy CTO. And then there were a bunch of other kind of folk around the campaign. But from a technology standpoint, a lot of the engineers from 2008, they weren't really engineers. They were more people who just happened to do technology. They didn't have experience with web. They didn't have experience building infrastructure. They didn't have that, you know, they didn't spend all their money in the early 2000s on servers or hack Audrey's. You know, they were just not that person. They weren't.
To your knowledge, was this the first campaign, presidential campaign, that really had some serious engineering behind it?
Yeah, I mean, to give you an idea, we had about 40 engineering technical staff. So like an engineering product manager, engineers, DBAs, DevOps, all of various types of, you know, roles that you would have in any normal enterprise. We had 40, whereas in the previous cycle there were 4.
Wow,
that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, and it's an interesting. It speaks to how important data, social media, all of this was. When you joined, what did they? What's obviously the end goal is to get President Obama reelected. But what was your job? What would they say? What do we want to do? Or is it get out the vote? Is it what is the task?
If there is one way, I mean, it's because it was such a big endeavor. The most important thing was to do everything, which is impossible.
Right.
But It was kind of like that, where we'd start and we'd be like, what are we supposed to do? They'd say, like, here's this list of everything. Just get it done.
So you're an engineer, although admittedly, you're probably the right guy for this, because you're obviously more creative than kind of a button-down IBM skinny black tie guy would be. But you still got to divide it up into pieces and take a bite of the elephant at a time. What did you decide to do first?
We approached this as a platform problem. We thought, how do we invest early so that later it's easier?
Oh, good.
Because we knew we had 18 months. We knew the last 6 months were going to be incredibly important, if not more important than the previous 12 months. And so we were just wondering, what does that mean and what do we build in this time? The job, if you were going to distill it, would be to support the field organization, and the fundraising organization, because that's pretty much what the campaign is, right? You raise a bunch of money to pay for the field organization, and then the field organization goes out and they do all these things that are incredibly important, but also a little bit anachronistic. They're knocking on doors, they're sending out mail, they're calling people on their landlines, and all of the stuff that isn't, it's not what normal people do. Like, I don't know the last time I have knocked on a door.
Right.
A life. I don't think I've knocked on a door in my adult life. You know, it just doesn't happen. Like, but you don't do
it's
that.
It's funny because politics hasn't changed that much in that sense. It's still retail. I remember in 1972 knocking, and I was 16, knocking on the doors for George McGovern and literally going from house to house saying, I'm talking about, you know, McGovern's presidential race and give you a pamphlet. Here's why he'd be a good president. And it hasn't changed. You still do that.
And so that's the part that's fascinating. And so when I came in, I had all these aspirations where I was like, you know, maybe we can, introduce a paperless field office. Maybe we can bring technology to all these places. We can use OCR so we can make the data entry more efficient. And those were all like, really pie in the sky. That didn't happen.
Right.
And we didn't have time to focus on it. I think maybe 2016, 2020, maybe something in the future that will happen. But right now, there's a very important thing that I had to learn, which was paper scales infinitely.
Yeah.
And old people can use paper.
I think this is the same challenge that every CTO and CIO ends up facing everywhere, which is you think this can all be automated and digitized, and in truth, it doesn't. It ends up, you still end up with pencils and paper. When the rubber meets the road, it's still rubber.
Remember this at Threadless one time, we had built something that didn't work for the warehouse, and they ended up just using a clipboard. In my head, I was like, but you have this software. And they were like, well, the clipboard works better. You know, it's hard. That's a hard thing to understand. And I think, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. There's a lot of ego that goes into building software. Because you say, I'm smart enough to understand your problem. So I'm going to distill that into the software piece and I'm going to deliver it to you.
I can do it better than you. I have a solution that's better than the one you're using.
And it was, so we had to learn very hard, the hard lesson of, we actually don't know what we're doing.
Right.
I know technology and I know how to program and we hired this amazing team. They all were very, very good programmers, amazing people. And we didn't know anything about politics. None of us were from a campaign. And so that really, you know, that there was a lot of work that needed to be done for us to understand the problem. And even though we were very smart people, we needed to be taught and we needed to understand that maybe there wasn't time to solve the paper problem, which wasn't actually a problem. In fact, that was a feature. Maybe there wasn't time to say, we're going to fix data entry because volunteers are an asset, and having them there means we can just keep adding. We can just keep adding and adding and adding. Here's more volunteers, which means we get more data. It was a good lesson, and I'm excited to apply it in the future.
Was there this kind of hybrid of old Pauls and the old way of doing, especially Chicago, where you got aldermen and, you know, I mean, you really have an organization. Was there this kind of meeting of the minds between the younger digital generation and the old school, or how were they present?
Sort of. I mean, the old Pauls obviously were there. The campaign used Axelrod and all of these great people all the time. But I mean, I don't know for certain, but I'm gonna just guess that the average age of the campaign was about 12.
pretty young.
About 24. We had all of these just incredibly smart young people. You may have seen the president's speech to the campaign staff the day after the election. And, you know, he's tearing up. He's talking about what a beautiful group of people we have. And the reason is because, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm 34. And around me are all these young people who have just done this amazing thing that no one has ever done before. This ground game that is, you know, is the first time in history that it's been this big. Turnout that no one expected.
Right.
A landslide that no one expected. And these are the leaders of the future.
Right.
Like, they're going to be Congress people. They're going to be, you know, the treasurer. When you have a young person who's like 22 and they aspire to be the treasurer, you're like, that's some serious. that's these people. And it's amazing. And I, you know, you just watch them and the passion that comes out of them is fascinating.
And that young man was Eric Schmidt, ladies and gentlemen. No.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was there.
I want to talk more. We're talking with Harper Reed, CTO of Obama for America, for at least a few more weeks. but it just, you know, I got a lot of questions I want to ask you. I want to ask you if you're political yourself. You know, is this an engineering problem or is this a passion project? I also want to ask how, and this is a tough one for you to answer, but I want you to be frank and honest. How important was Narwhal and this to the winning of the election? It seems to me it was very important, but I'd like to know what you think. We'll come back with you in just a bit with Harper Reed. We'll also give you a chance to ask your questions in the chat room. So if you're watching live, irc.twit.tv, questions for Harper Reed. It's fast. I mean, really, campaigns have changed. In some ways, they're the same and haven't changed in at least since I was doing it 50 years. 1972 is 40 years ago. But in some ways, they've changed an awful lot. I got a direct message from President Obama's Twitter account on November 1st saying, help us get out the vote. So that's definitely different. I don't think anybody... Pardon me?
Think of that. When you got that, what did you think?
I laughed. It was good.
Did you go help? Did you go help?
I don't dare use my Twitter account for politics. I will be honest. I am an Obama supporter. I voted for him both times, and I gave money to the campaign. But I didn't want to use my Twitter account for politics. But I thought it was interesting. I mean, I've gotten text messages for the last 4 years from the campaign, but I'd never gotten a direct message on Twitter. And the message was kind of interesting because it said use your Twitter influence to help turn out the vote.
Yeah.
And I probably did tweet vote. I probably did do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which that's a lot.
Yeah, getting out the vote is a, you know, I mean, that's nonpartisan. Everybody should vote, whatever your opinion.
That's the thing I think people forget. When you talk about, like, voter access, how important it is to make sure everyone has an opportunity to vote and to make sure that any, you know, whatever side it is that we are aggressively making sure that anyone, no matter who you are, has an equal opportunity to go and vote for their guy.
Right.
Lee,
it's the
woman.
It's the fundamental process of democracy. Now, I have to say, I did not get any tweets from the Romney campaign, but I sure got a hell of a lot of email from Ryan, especially. I seem for somehow the vice presidential candidate, I got more email from him than I did from Romney. But anyway, we'll talk about that in more. We got to take a break. Harper Reed is our guest, CTO of Obama for America. It is old and new, but it's fascinating. It's how elections will be won in the future, for sure. Mm-hmm. Just like mail, just like sending mail. It's old, but it's new. You still put a stamp on an envelope and put it in a box so the mail carrier takes it, but you don't have to go to the post office and buy stamps anymore. You can print mail, right? You can print postage with your computer and your printer and Stamps.com. Stamps.com is, you know, the federal government said, yes, we give you the right to do this. And it's awesome because essentially This is the pro way to do mailing. Now, if you're just mailing out your Christmas card list, I don't think you need stamps.com. But if you do mailing every day, if you send out invoices, it takes it right from QuickBooks or your address book. If you're an eBay, Amazon, PayPal, Etsy seller, you know you're doing a lot of mailing, right? Wouldn't it be nice to just say, here's the package, plop it on that USB scale, have the form printed out. You don't even have to type in the name of the recipient because they take it from the eBay account and put it in the, if it's an international mailing, it fills out the forms, and then lo and behold, the mail carrier comes and takes it all off your hands. You didn't even get up from your desk. That's what I'm talking about. This is a pro tip for heavy duty mailers. Stamps.com. Now here's the deal. You can go to stamps.com right now and get that $80 special offer. That's a good deal. $25 in postage, the scale. But wait a minute. If you click, you said where said heard about it on a podcast, click that. And enter in our offer code, Triangulation. That's the name of the show, Triangulation. And press go. And look at that. No longer an $80 value. It's a $55 in free postage, the digital scale, the supply kit, and a four-week trial. Just for typing in one word, Triangulation. Use that special offer and give Stamps.com a no-risk trial for a month. Cancel and pay nothing, but keep the scale as our gift to you. It's a really great service. We actually have two accounts here because we do enough mailing at this point that it's just a big time saver and money saver for us. Stamps.com. Harper, I keep wanting to say Harper Lee. Was your mom a fan of To Kill a Mockingbird?
You know, I don't know. Maybe.
Is it an old family name, Harper?
It's an old family name, but I didn't find that out until I met a startup that did genealogy that was like, oh, by the way, we did some research on you, and it happens to be a family name. Oh, and I talked to my dad, like, well, yeah, it is. We just never told you.
Here's a great picture of Harper and the president. A big hug the day, I would guess this is the day after the election. Were you motivated to do this because you supported Obama or because this was a technological exercise that you couldn't resist?
Probably both. I was very, I mean, I was definitely dedicated to the candidate and the president. I had seen him when he was running for Senate in Chicago on the street and just talking to people on the street. And it was just this kind of exciting, fun experience. To be a part of that for a very quick moment. And then when he later ran for president in 2008, I helped out making some calls at headquarters. And I really wondered, like, why or how would I get involved more? And so that was one of the things when I got involved this cycle was trying to make getting an opportunity to allow more engineers and people like me to get involved. Yes, political, but the problems that we came into, which was how do we run a giant, giant enterprise, build it up in like 15 months, run it for a couple months, and then shut it down in 3 days.
Your direct competition for the RNC, Carol Davidson, who left Microsoft to become a product manager for Narwhal, the Republicans' equivalent of what you she worked with you. I'm sorry, she was product manager for Narwhal. Not your competition, your coworker, said that there was no one else like Harper that could have assembled these people so quickly, get them to take a pay cut and move to Chicago. It wasn't a great job, so you had to talk people into it, obviously. And yet it's the greatest job of all.
That hard to talk people into it.
Yeah.
What it was you had to find the best people, and we had to find them very quickly. And so we needed people to see – we needed people who would quit their jobs pretty quickly without thinking about it, without questioning it.
For a job that is not going to last more than a year or two.
Oh, but luckily, startup people apparently don't really
care.
So we hired a lot of startup people. And a lot of them just came from my personal network. So, you know, if you've met me in the past, I considered you for and probably tried to hire you aggressively. And for the most part, this is kind of how it went. I would call them on the phone and I would say, hey, I have this really great opportunity. We're building some really big software for the president. How would you like to work for the president? Here's some of the problems we're trying to solve. And then the answer usually was yes or wrong team.
No, I'm going to work for Orca. All right. Now I have to point out, in 2008, there was, I take it, according to a Alexis Madrigal writing in The Atlantic, and this is a great article, which I highly recommend, about Harper and his team, called When the Nerds Go Marching In. But Alexis says that in 2008, there was a similar program called Houdini that crashed on Election Day. Mm. And in fact, isn't that what happened to Orca, which was the Republicans' tool?
Yeah. So Orca, and the thing about Orca that I find fascinating, and this has been a little bit frustrating, just because Orca was a small software product that helped with poll tracking and counting voters in the polling places.
The idea was that the volunteers in the polling place would have an iPhone app, and they'd be able to track who came in and then say, oh, Joe didn't report. He was gonna vote one of ours. Let's go get him and bring him to the polls. It's pretty right. simple. It was a get-out-the-vote app.
Exactly. And so it allowed us to know who to focus on.
Right.
And so that was what Orca did, and that was actually what Houdini did. And in 2012, we had the same app, but it was called Gordon. And so Orca...
By the way... Okay, go ahead. Okay, explain the naming.
So since Houdini failed in 2008, no one wanted anything to do with Houdini, so we named it Gordon because Gordon killed Houdini.
He's the man who killed Houdini. Houdini. And by the way, your program, Narwhal, there's an animal that feeds on narwhals. They're called orcas.
Right. So the Republicans, honestly, they really screwed this up. They came out with I don't know where it was, on PBS or something, early on, they said, or right before the election, they said, the Orca, this is a Project Orca, it's really great, and you may notice the name is very peculiar. The name is not an acronym. It is the only predator of the narwhal.
That's cocky.
And the thing that's sad about this is... technology is not a place to be cocky, because you can screw so many things up with technology. Your provider will go down, your hard drives will light on fire, EC2 disappears, it comes back quickly, whatever, so many things can happen that being arrogant like that, I think that's really where they screwed up. Because then when it had some problems, which I have no idea what the problems were, and they were so out front about how it was going to kill Narwhal, that was then the media message.
Right.
When really the media message should have been, the ground game is really awesome, because the ground game was amazing. And that was the innovation.
When you say the ground game, you're not talking, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the field organization, Jeremy Bird, Mitch Stewart, these guys who were able to go out and just grab all of these volunteers, point them in the right direction, and aggressively knock on doors.
The analog portion of the campaign.
And that was the big innovation, is taking, using technology to try and make sure that is more efficient.
So let me ask the question then. How important was Narwhal to the victory?
So Narwhal, let me explain what Narwhal is real quick.
Yeah.
The easiest way to explain of Narwhal is, do you know parse.com?
No. What is parse.com?
Is an API that allows, that it just kind of powers mobile apps. So it does like users, it does some commerce stuff, it does all sorts of things. So you can do like in-app purchases very easily on your mobile apps.
It's a framework for mobile apps.
Yeah, roughly. So if you were to take this and find the campaign equivalent, a framework for campaign apps, that's really what Narwhal was. It was a conceptual project that we just used a code. There was a code name for all of our APIs.
So this is what you were saying at the beginning. You decided, when you had a lot of free time at 18 months out, to build a platform so that you could then build apps on top of the platform.
Right. And this is hard to describe, because the press kind of took it and ran with it and said, OMG, Narwhal killed Orca, and they're synonymous with one another, which they actually weren't anywhere near each other. What it really was Narwhal was this concept of our APIs, all of them, whether it was fundraising or get out the vote or field or social or emailing or Twitter or Facebook, whatever it was, we created an API so that our apps could use it. The best usage of this was if you logged into any of our apps, that used Narwhal.
Right.
If you contributions, that used Narwhal. If you received...
So Gordon would be more the equivalent of Orca. Gordon was an app that sat on the Narwhal platform, like along with other apps.
Actually sat on a different platform.
Oh.
Because it's never simple, is it?
I just understood, and now apparently I didn't.
So Narwhal actually worked with, or not Narwhal, Gordon worked with one of our vendors, VanNGP, which they built it and they ran it and it worked incredibly well and didn't go down.
So that begs the question, why create a platform? Couldn't you build this on something existing?
You know, we went through that, we looked at our options, but there's so much purpose-built software that we would have ended up building something. We just wanted to make sure that we had the performance on our side, that we took the time to make sure that it wouldn't go down, that it wouldn't, have any problems. And we hired aggressively people who knew scale. And so we wanted to make sure that we could back into that scale that we knew how to build. With that said, VanNGP, those guys killed it and were able to support us through Election Day. And that was great. And their Gordon was awesome. They also integrated directly with Narwhal, which meant that when you entered that data, it flowed through Narwhal and you could, pull all sorts of data from it. And then we could figure out how to do things.
It's really interesting how close to the same decisions IT makes all the time in an enterprise. You have a critical project with a very specific timeline. You have a drop dead date. You have to make the build or buy decision. Are we going to build this ourselves? Are we going to buy something existing? All of this kind of is the same thing that goes on all the time in enterprises all over the world.
Yeah, there's really no difference.
Yeah. So, again, how important was this to the campaign, though? Could the same campaign have happened without the software, without the technology?
I think that the campaign would have been basically the same without technology. Okay. What we offer. And this is big, but what we offered was efficiency, the force multiplier. Right. I think of this a lot. My mom volunteered for the campaign, and I thought of her. She was kind of the person where I was like, okay, she's the volunteer in my brain.
You're designing it for mom, yeah.
How all software should be designed. But the key was, I didn't want her. I knew she was going to work a lot. So let's say she's working 40 hours a week, 60 hours a week. I wanted to make sure that those counted. So if we could make tools to make sure that she's knocking on the right doors, or if we can make a tool that makes sure that when she's using the call tool, that the calls that she's making are effective. So she's not calling, hardcore red Republicans who are just going to tell her to off or whatever.
It's a waste of time. Don't waste your time.
No, exactly. And we don't want to waste those people's time. Right. So the idea here is that being that force multiplier, which is exactly what technology should be in all situations. It should never be the focus. It should be the thing that makes that work better, makes it work more efficiently. And I aggressively think that, this is something that it's a little bit hard as a technologist to admit that this could be possible, but I think they did a pretty good job. They could have done it without us.
Right. So let me talk a little bit about Narwhal and what it was. What was it? NoSQL? What is going on? What do you got here? It's a database primarily, yes?
Used I'm going to use a technical ton here, term here, an ASTON. It was just absolutely ridiculous how much AWS we used. And
That's the Amazon platform.
Amazon AWS. I recently talked to them, and I kept calling it Amazon, because when I say Amazon to tech people, they're like, oh, yeah, EC2. They know immediately. But if you talk to Amazon, they get all riled up, and they're like, oh, you mean AWS. And I was like, well, yeah, it's the same thing. And they're like, no. So I've been trained to say AWS.
Now, that's nice because it scales. It's affordable. You use what you need. When you need more, it scales up more. And its uptime is pretty good. It's not perfect.
It's good enough. And this is something I learned. And I learned this from a Hacker News thread, and I think it's hilarious. If Amazon is down and you go to Netflix and Netflix is up, then you are screwing up your infrastructure. But if you go to Netflix and Netflix is down, then Amazon's actually down. So they give you all of the tools to make yourself redundant, to make sure that in any scenario, right, you have backups. And we, so if, as long as you follow that, fine.
We do that ourselves. We have it set up so that if we suddenly get a lot of demand, we can turn on instances of EC2 and provide us with more bandwidth, more server, and all of that.
Yep. And so we use that. So Narwhal was backed by RDS, which is a MySQL data store. Mm-hmm. And then it used a little bit of Dynamo, which is their kind of NoSQL data store. It used a lot of Qs, which is their SQS product. We used everything they would offer us. If they said, hey, you want to try this out? We were like, yes, we do want to try that out. So we used EC2, obviously, a bunch, a lot of S3, a little bit of CloudFront. It was amazing. It was incredibly automated. I have to give a shout out to our DevOps crew. Scott Vandenplas was the lead there, and it was pretty awesome and pretty epic for those guys.
Were you getting a lot of transactions at once? I mean, how busy was this database?
It was very busy. I don't have any numbers in front of me, but let's just say it was busy.
Especially, it's very peaky because it's all going to happen on election day.
We saw this graph that, you know, it's your typical hockey stick graph. And we thought, you know, that from 2008. And we thought, you know, I wonder what it's going to be like. And just starting a couple days out, because the election day is actually 4 days, starting a couple days out, we just start getting more traffic. And then the next day, it'd be like twice as much. And then the next day, it'd be twice as much as that. And we were just like, I wonder when it's going to stop. And it didn't stop. It didn't stop until we won. And when we won, everyone was like, okay. And then it all stopped just flatly.
It got very calm, very fast. The article that Alexis wrote talks about an October 21st trial of this, in which you were essentially a dungeon master.
Actually, wasn't me. It was my partner Dylan, who I'm hopefully working with in the future. He was a dungeon master with one of our DevOps guys. And my favorite story here is, let's talk a little bit about what we were trying to do. We were trying to figure out how to get the engineers more involved. And we are having dinner with Etsy's VP of engineering, Mark. And we're just talking and like talking about how do we get engineers more excited about things. And he suggested doing a game day where we focus on failing and kind of just breaking, because everything is able to, getting the engineers in a place where they can fix things very quickly will get them to understand their infrastructure more, will be able to understand how to react, and it will kind of add camaraderie and bring everyone together. So we were like, this is a great idea. So we did that for all of October.
Wow.
And we did it because we wanted to focus on making our software platform fail safe instead of having it be just fail, which often I think happens with technology. We want it to be where, much like a space shuttle or much like, you know, a plane, where you can still land if there's a failure and the passengers don't die.
Right.
However, we would need to make sure that if there was a failure of any sorts, Amazon, RDS, our own human failures, which is often what it is, it's up and the users don't notice. And so we just practiced until we got it down, Pat. And we had no problem.
And Dylan was just giving them scenario after scenario?
Forgot about that. So Dylan would set up and he'd send a schedule out. And he'd say, okay, here's the scenario for our game day on Sunday. Everyone would be like, oh, exciting. And they'd look at this game day. And then they would they'd get the schedule. And the first time, like, they'd be like, okay, we're going to turn off RDS. We're going to turn off the master. And so we turn off the master, and everyone would be like, well, the master's off, just like we thought it was going to be. And then he would also disconnect all of the EBS volumes.
Now what are you going to do?
Mess up the whole schedule. And then they're like, what? This is not how we planned. And because he didn't want it to plan. But then we had a DevOps guy, Nick Hatch, who took it very seriously. And so he'd be in Campfire, which is a chat program we used. And he'd sit in Campfire and he'd say, like, and StallionDB, which is a play on our database consultants, PalominoDB, uh-huh. StallionDB walks in and says the databases are down. And then he'd just take all the databases down. And everyone would just be like, oh, man. It was really fun to watch these guys kind of have fun screwing everything up. And the first day we did this, or not the first day, but the first day we spent a lot of time, like a whole day on it, the next day Amazon did go down. And we were able to basically avoid downtime due to them going down because we knew how to react and we knew how to move things very quickly from one data center to another or what have you. It also helped us when Sandy went through the East Coast. All of our data centers were on the East Coast and we were able to move everything to the West Coast very quickly.
That's impressive. That's really impressive.
It was not easy.
Yeah. And then what happens to this now? I mean, it sounds like you built something pretty amazing. Is it just kind of get disassembled and?
You know, we're trying to figure that out. It's going to continue to support the president and some of his policies, like the fiscal cliff stuff, and try and do some grassroots around that. You know, I guess stay tuned. I don't have a good answer for you, but I'm really hoping that it lives longer than this election. We built some neat stuff, and I think it could be a really neat platform for, you know, Democrats forever.
Well, and I said this to Clay Johnson because it seemed after 2008 that the president had the social media down. He had all the tools, and he could have used it for 4 years to have an open, transparent government, to talk to people and engage people, to enlist their help, and it just kind of disappeared. And Clay said, well, you know, government doesn't move very fast. There's a lot of Windows XP machines in there, and it just, you know, takes a long time to do this stuff.
We wanted to open source it. And so I was like, we should open source it, you know, and everyone's like, okay, we should open source it. And so we're going to, you know, it just sits there for a while.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely correct. It is not a fast.
Will it? Do you think it'll be open source? That would be amazing.
I think we'll see some of it. We did do some open source during the campaign where we open sourced voter registration, a voter registration app that anyone could use. And I hope some people used it. And it was an amazing experience. We kind of screwed up the licensing because we were worried about voter fraud. But hopefully we can, you know, release things MIT license and let people use it all over the internets, because we did a lot of things that will help you scale websites, not just reelect a president.
That's awesome. Yeah. Stuff that could be useful in a lot of realms, but torture tested. What was that? Was there an impedance mismatch? I mean, you're a pretty hip looking guy. Did you feel comfortable when you walk into the White House? I mean,
I haven't actually been to the White House ever.
Well, that's not right.
I imagine someday I'll go, but you don't. There's a big differentiation between White House and campaign staff.
You're just off in a corner somewhere.
Yeah. So we took out all the light bulbs and we made it comfortable, and we just kind of sat in our little world and programmed. But actually, where we were in this awesome. Let me rephrase it. We're in this smaller office in downtown Chicago in the Prudential Tower with 600 of our closest friends and coworkers.
Wow.
And in an open workspace. And it was very loud. It was like a trading floor, except we were reelecting the president. And it was it got brutal, actually. It was you'd come in and you'd be like, man, we need to order some deodorant for the campaign. It was pretty fun. I mean, it was such a great experience because you got to work with people every day. And but the bathrooms were a war zone.
But this is what you hope for in life, that you get a challenge that makes a difference, that engages you, that you get to do something big and fun.
Yep.
it's a once in a lifetime. Maybe not. If you're lucky, it might be more than once. But it's certainly one of those things where as it's happening, I hope that you kind of go, wow, this is cool.
There was a bunch of those experiences where you were like, this will never happen again.
We're talking with Harper Reed. We'll give you a chance to ask some questions. He's currently still the CTO of Obama for America, helped build the platform that was used, the data platform that was used during the campaign. And I know Harper won't take credit for it, but I think, you know, if everybody was surprised by the voter turnout, by the number of votes, both popular and electoral, that the president got, I think a lot of that can be accredited to the software that the campaign used. It was certainly the big difference between the two campaigns. We're going to take a break, come back in just a little bit, find out what's next for Harper Reed, and ask your questions, too, if you've got some. They want to know how much Mountain Dew was consumed.
There was a lot of Mountain Dew consumed, but the DevOps team did this thing that was disgusting, where they mixed Red Bull with these caffeine like candies called Sheets, and they called it the Bullsheet.
I've had Red Bull once, and I've had Sheets. I would not want to mix.
No, they're terrible. It's brutal. And then every once in a while, they'd mix it with the 5-Hour Energy.
Oh, that's just you're not even coherent. You're awake.
Not appropriate. It was inappropriate.
That makes me give a Howard Dean. Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did that over and over again.
We'll be back in just a second, but first a word from our friends at Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. You know, I know most of you in our audience both are media creators and media users. I mean, there really is an intersection. In fact, the folks at Pond5 have told me that most of their members do both. They buy media, illustrations, videos, films, vector illustrations, music tracks, sound effects from Pond5, royalty-free for use in their productions. And then they also sell their stuff, their videos, their vector illustrations, their photos on Pond5. It actually makes a lot of sense. Pond5 is really almost a co-op, and they give you the largest royalties possible. You set, largest in the business, you set the price, and they give, and then you split it 50-50. So you get to determine how much you're going to make. Pond5 makes it very easy. If you go to pond5.com, they've got the best browser and a shopping cart to make it very easy to get the media you need for your next production. Boy, look at the number of clips, too. 1.3 million video clips, almost 10,000 new ones this week alone. 8 million photos, 45,000 new this week alone. All the categories, the illustrator, the 3D models, it's just incredible what they've got. And they even have free media every week, so you can go over there, you know, without the watermark on there, go over there and download it. But I got a special deal for you, 50 free stock media files right now, just so you can get an idea of how Pond5 works. All you have to do is go to pond5.com/triangulation, and you can download up to 50 free stock media files in all the different categories. The idea is you'll make an account with Pond5, you'll get a sense of how it works, get a sense of the quality of the media there, and I'm sure they hope you'll come back and become a Pond5 customer and a Pond5 seller. Really beautiful stuff. Don't forget the sound effects and loops and music, too. Great for podcast producers, things like that. Simple backgrounds like that. Everything you need. Next time you're putting together a keynote or a PowerPoint, go to pond5.com. And, you know, might as well right now just download those 50 media files. pond5.com/triangulation. The world's stock media marketplace. This is the modern way of doing stock media. Pond5.com. So it's almost over. You're winding it down. Are you looking for a job, Harper? Would you like to stay? Aren't they supposed to like give you a cabinet job or something like that? Like,
I'm looking for an ambassadorship.
Okay,
No, I'm not. I mean, since this is a re-election, a lot of those jobs in the administration are taken by people who are doing them. So, you know, they don't just want to remove them and say new people. And the other thing is I interrupted my plan with my partner, Dylan Richard, to build a company to do this. And so we just are trying to go back to that and get on that train. And suddenly I have a lot more people interested to help me, which is good. A little weird and fun.
Yeah. Will you work with, besides Dylan, other people that you worked with on Narwhal?
Yeah, we're hoping to bring, you know, I mean, we had a lot of products. So we had probably maybe 280 repos that were being deployed at any given moment. It was astonishing how big the team was and how many products we had. So regardless of what, you know, I choose to do in the future, I'm pretty sure that we are going to be working with a lot of those guys.
Yeah. And when you said in this field, is it going to be a political tool or?
No. Probably some back office-y thing or some enterprise solution, just because that's what we know best And that's what we have been doing. And I mean, that's what basically roughly what I did at Threadless, and it's what I did at the campaign. And, you know, I'm excited to continue doing it.
Yeah, really, really cool. So how much longer before you get to move on? Or you're still there now?
A couple days.
Not long.
Yeah.
After election day, was it kind of a letdown? Okay, we're done.
I mean, I do think it was one of those experiences where I kept wanting to go downtown and go to my office and hang out with my coworkers and work with all these amazing people even afterwards. But, you know, we'd been really aggressively running for 18 months.
Yeah.
So we, you know, there was no weekends for the last 6 months. Everyone was working very late. It was pretty much 24 hours a day for the last month at least. And so it was interesting. I mean, I don't want to do that again.
You must have been bone tired. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we were very tired. I just booked a trip to an unnamed location where I'm not bringing the internet.
Good thinking. I just did that.
What was it like? I am scared.
I was a little shaky. You know, though, it was on a boat, and they do the same kind of fire drills you were doing. They go, okay, they come on the loudspeaker and say, all right, the passengers, don't listen to this. Okay, crew, there's a fire in the forward hold, and we're leaking oil, and you better get the... And they do a drill. Or they did one, we've just run aground, and water's leaking into holds 3 and 4. You know, fire teams report, and it's great. This is what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You try to you break it and you see what happens, and then you're ready when it does break.
The reason you do that, I think, is so that you can react calmly.
Right.
It's when you are reacting out of emotion or out of fear,
right,
that make mistakes, or when you haven't done it before. And so, if you can try and imagine every failure possible and just go through and actually, you have to act them out. You cannot just write down what the solution is. You have to do it.
Right.
You have to do it. Amazon allows you to do that on a dev instance or a staging. We just lit up a new instance through there. I think that is so important for any enterprise, for any startup, for any web app to say, what happens if my database disappears and how do we recover?
Right.
The best example of this is restore from your backups. It never works.
But you wouldn't know that unless you tried it.
To try, and when you try and you're like, well, this doesn't work, and then you keep doing it until it works, and then you just keep doing that and keep doing that, and eventually there'll be very few emergencies that are actually emergencies.
Right. I remember that when growing up watching NASA, watching space flight, and that's the training. You have to have muscle memory for every possible contingency. So it's just automatic, and you can be calm, and you go, yeah, you push this button.
And our engineers were like, well, the databases are all down, but that's fine. And, you know, I'm like freaking out. I'm like, what do you mean? Got it. It's under control. You know, or here's an example. During one of the debates, we were taking more money than we'd ever taken before, and we needed to resize one of our databases. So we actually had to take one of our databases down that ran some of the debates. And that was incredibly scary. It took 3 minutes of downtime, and nobody noticed.
That's like changing engines mid-flight.
Yeah, people always try and use the analogy of like, well, you're building the plane while you're flying, right, or whatever. And it was, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, we discovered we were flying and then had to invent wings.
Did you have anything to do with the president's AMA? Did you know he was going to do that?
So I had introduced the campaign to Alexis. Maybe like a couple months before that, and
Alexis,
they had chatted.
The founder of Reddit, yeah.
So we just kind of like, you know, they had connected, and then just one day they were like, "Hey, I think we're going to do an AMA with the president," and my head exploded.
Yeah.
And as soon as I got up, I was like, "This is awesome." And they're like, "Don't tell anyone." So we were like, "Okay, we won't tell anyone." Very few people knew. A very core small group, and then Teddy Goff, who was the director of digital, flew to where the president was and sat with the president while the president did the AMA in real time. And then we sat in Chicago in like a war room where we had campfire up in a chat, and we were all pasting questions and links and, you know, into a campfire chat so that the people in Virginia with the president could look at them and give him the questions to respond to. It was amazing.
I wish I had that kind of team when I did my AMA.
So you should, if you do it again, you should invite some friends to just sit in the chat room with you and help find the questions, because there's so much good content that gets buried.
Right.
And the only way to push it up is to answer it.
Right.
And so we have all over the page, and you know, you can have someone that Googles something for you. And I think you only need one or two people, and it doesn't take that long to do a very good AMA where you are just answering the questions, you know, that are the best questions, rather than just answering it from the top down.
Right. That's what I tried to do, and you can't keep up because there were 1,000 questions, and I'm typing. It was crazy. Have you done one? You should do one.
I'm waiting a little tiny bit until some of the news dies down a little bit so we can have a real discussion rather than just talk about Orca and Narwhal.
Right. But that would be fascinating. I would really I'd be very interested. You know, I'm trying to think. So here's a guy who knows how to scale, who knows how to make stuff work, never fail, who can, you know, it can create a user interface that even his mom can use. I'm trying to think, who would hire? Has Apple called you yet?
No. I don't make simple enough interfaces.
You would? That they need you, dude. Forget buying Twitter. They should buy Harper Reed.
Buy Twitter? Is that what's happening?
No. It was a blog post. Harper, it was really great to talk to you again. I was so impressed when I met you because you're so, you know, they're going, that's the CTO for Obama for America, and he works for the president. And you're so down to earth and normal and real and fun, and you were a very, very good townsperson.
Yeah, I was.
Until I ate you. Harper Reed, so nice to meet you. HarperReed.com, @Harper, very nice Twitter handle, actually, @Harper, if you want to follow him. And I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We do Triangulation every Wednesday, 4 p.m. Yeah, between 3 and 4, depends. Leo time, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That would be 2300 UTC if you want to watch. We do like it when you watch live because I take feedback from the chat room and all of that. But if you can't, you know, we always make audio and video on demand available at twit.tv and wherever you can get your podcasts, your iTunes and everywhere else. We have some great future guests lined up. Next week it's Guy Kawasaki. You said we're booked through January now. Are we doing a best of? We should do a best of. So, all right, we are going to do a best of. So if you have we've done now, 81 great interviews. If there's some best of from this year that you'd like to see for the Christmas week, go to twit.tv/best of and fill out whatever you know. You don't have to fill out, you know, it says, what's the time code? You don't have to know the time code. Just say, oh, when Leo was talking to Nolan Bushnell and they talked about Steve Jobs on the banks of the Seine, that was a good one. Something like that. That's all we need to know, and then we'll figure out where in that interview that happened. And we'll put it all together in some of the best moments. We've got so many great ones for the holiday week. I think that's December 26th, the day after Christmas. Also, we're working on Rick Smolin, who just did a book about big data that's amazing. He's the photographer who did the Day in the Life books. And some other great... Who else we got coming up? You got anybody else, Karsten, we should plug? Karsten? Harry McCracken, that'd be fun. Karsten Bondi is our producer, by the way. Thank you, Karsten, for the work you do. And our technical director is John Slanina. Nice job on the board. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation.